Our final case of the day is Blackman versus the Secretary of the Department of Corrections. Looks like we're still waiting for our counsel.
May it please the court. I'm Richard Suma. I represent the appellant Gregory Blackman. In this appeal, we argue that Mr. Blackman received ineffective assistance from his state appellate counsel, who overlooked the trial court's failure to advise Blackman of the dangers of joint representation and failed to obtain a valid waiver of the right of conflict-free counsel. This error was contrary to the well-established law of the Supreme Court in the Holloway decision, or in the alternative, the Kyler v. Sullivan decision. In this case, as in Holloway, the trial court was on notice of conflict of interest through representation.
Counsel, I'm concerned about no showing of prejudice in this case. Nobody talks about prejudice, Strickland prejudice. What is the prejudice? What's the evidence of the prejudice in the case?
Okay, Your Honor, thank you. As in the Holloway case,
this is not structural error. You follow me?
I understand.
Under Strickland, so you've got to show ineffective assistance in performance and also prejudice, and I'm having a hard time with the prejudice element.
Yes, I can address that, Your Honor. Thank you. As in the Holloway case, the court instructed us that the dangers of joint representation include what the attorney may forego doing. And those dangers include the possibility of plea negotiations, the possibility of one client testifying for the prosecution in exchange for a lesser charge or favorable sentencing. Now, in this case, those considerations are paramount, because Mr. Blackman enjoyed, the dubious status of a prison releasee reoffender under Florida law. Now, that means that if convicted of robbery, he would face a mandatory sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole. And I think you can imagine, Your Honor, that a person in that position has an extremely high incentive or motive to try to negotiate for like a lesser charge to get away from that minimum mandatory sentence of life in prison. Now, on the facts of this,
what you're doing is making the structural error argument. A lot of unknowns. We don't know what could have happened if they had a plea agreement or negotiations or this, that, and the other thing. And there's no evidence of any of that. This is not a structural error case. We're on collateral attack. If this case had been on direct appeal, and you're making this argument on direct appeal, you have a different argument altogether.
Well, Your Honor, I think I respectfully disagree, because if this case does fall under the Holloway decision, the Supreme Court says that's an error that in which reversal is automatic, and that sounds
Those are structural error cases on direct appeal. This is a collateral attack under Strickland. So the burden is to show ineffective assistance performance by the lawyer. At trial, and then prejudice. The outcome would have been different, and they had the same evidence in both of these cases, both these defendants, in my understanding.
Yes, and I think it did affect the attorney's performance, because if he had loyalty to just Mr. Blackman.
Counsel, you talk about his attorney as though it could be the trial attorney or appellate attorney. The only COA we granted on the Holloway type issue is as to the appellate counsel. And there was no objection. So you don't have a valid claim unless you can point to actual adverse effect on the trial counsel. And there's nothing in the record that the appellate counsel had, nothing that shows an actual adverse effect on the trial counsel, is there?
Well, to begin with, I respectfully agree with the assertion that there was no objection.
You mean disagree?
Yes, yes, Your Honor. I respectfully disagree with the assertion that there was no objection, because this is a case where the
objection voiced by the two defendants was to being tried in a consolidated trial because of the evidence that might come in against each other that wouldn't otherwise come in. That was the only dissatisfaction they had. Neither one of them ever said, I object to being represented by the same attorney who represents my co-defendant because I want somebody loyal only to me, or anything approximating that. The only objection voiced, and this was by the one or both of the co-defendants, was, I don't want to be tried jointly. Evidence will come in that wouldn't otherwise come in. And the district court's response to that is, no, Mr. Blackmon, you're being tried as a principal. It'll all come in. So there was no objection to conflict of interest joint representation, was there?
Yes, there was, Your Honor. And I would point out that the...
Quote it to me. Don't just say yes. Tell me where it was.
At a pretrial hearing of February 5th, the hearing on the motion to consolidate the cases, the co-defendant Earl uttered the magic words, conflict of interest. And that's at the document 20-1, ECF page number 176.
And you're representing Earl in this case, correct?
No, I'm representing Blackmon.
So what good does Earl's objection that a conflict of interest might harm him have to do with your client?
Well, Your Honor, the Blackmon's attorney at that time, Mr. Ward, agreed with Mr. Earl's assertion and said, Mr. Blackmon is in a different position because at most, Blackmon was not at the scene of the crime. So, and there's a history of the prior attorneys withdrawing from the case due to conflict of interest. Both the first counsel said there was a conflict of interest. The second counsel said there was a conflict of interest. And even at the jury selection proceeding, Mr. Blackmon's attorney never said there was no conflict of interest. He said there was a waiver, or the prosecutor himself said, at this point, I think it would be wise to put on a waiver of the conflict of interest. So everybody recognized there was a conflict of interest. The question in this case should boil down to as to what was said at that hearing established an effective waiver of conflict of interest. And the performance of the trial counsel was effective, and the appellate counsel should have known it, because Mr. Blackmon, if he had agreed to testify or entered into negotiations with the state to testify for the state, it's very likely, and this is a case where the state needed corroborating evidence, no doubt, it's very likely that he may have been able to negotiate something or agree to a lesser charge, such as accessory after the fact to robbery, and provide the corroboration that the state really would like to have in a case like this, because there's no identification of the suspects directly.
Is it in the record that he ever asked to testify, that he ever asked his attorney, told his attorney that he wanted to testify?
Well, when Mr. Blackmon filed his motion in the appellate court for his claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, he said he knew he would like to testify, especially after when the evidence produced at trial showed an actual conflict, when Mr. Chester, the informant, or the co-defendant who testified for the state, said that Mr. Earl told him that he saw Blackmon driving up and down the street as a lookout. He knew that Blackmon was effectively then a witness against him, and he would like to explain why
He could have filed an ineffective assistance claim against the trial lawyer in a 3.850 proceeding, challenging the competence of trial lawyer, the performance.
He did that also.
Yeah, I understand. He lost, didn't he?
Yes, sir.
And why did he lose? Because there was no prejudice.
But there was
that why he lost?
I'm sure it's why he lost, but that was on a different issue as to the performance of trial counseling.
I understand that, but he had the right to file a 3.850 motion in the circuit court challenging the competence of trial counsel.
I think
which would have included he didn't let me testify, just all things like that. The problem with your argument to me is it's all supposition. There's just nothing in the record.
I would
just say, if this had happened, this could have happened, this could have happened, and this could have happened.
I would respectfully disagree, because as a lay person being represented by counsel, he perhaps did not realize that trial counsel should have discussed the possibility of plea negotiations before trial, but he realized it afterwards, and that gave rise to a claim that that appellate counsel should have realized also.
I'm talking about after the appeal was over, after the habeas petition on charging him competency on part of the appellate lawyer, after that, all of that's over, he could go back in the circuit court, file a 3.850 motion, and challenge the effective assistance of his trial lawyer, which would have included all these things. I could have testified. All that would have been in the record.
I think that may be possible, but I don't think a litigant is restricted to only that one remedy. I think the proper effect.
Then what you're asking us to do is, it's a strategic decision on his part not to do that. And so now we're in the posture of appellate counsel. We're supposed to surmise all these things. That's why I said at the beginning that your argument sounds to me like a structural error argument that is made on direct appeal. But on collateral attack, you have to show Strickland prejudice. But outcome of the proceeding would have been different.
Well,
not the appeal, the trial.
I understand, but I think there are alternate remedies to available. And as a pro se person at that point, he took the remedy of filing a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. And I think he was entitled to that.
Would we make a different rule for pro se litigants and represented litigants?
No, but I think the prejudice that is manifest in the record is available also in the claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. And I'm out of time, so I'll back off.
Thank you. You still reserved your 3 minutes. Mr. Jordan.
Good afternoon or good morning. May it please the court, Brian Jordan, representing the Secretary of the Florida Department of Corrections. In Cullen v. Penholster, the Supreme Court made it very clear that review under the AEDPA is limited to the record that was before the court that adjudicated the claim on merits. In this case, the record that was before the Florida First District Court of Appeal, the court that adjudicated this claim on the merits, fully supports the district court, U.S. District Court's conclusion that Blackman's expressed concern on the record was to a consolidated trial, not joint representation. In that record, there was no mention or allusion to any conflict with joint representation, nor would that have been evident to the first DCA from the record in its evaluation of appellate counsel's representation. As to the actual conflict that Mr. Blackman says arose during co-defendant Chester's testimony, nothing within that testimony alone would have alerted appellate counsel or the state court what Blackman alleged was an off-the-record conversation with counsel.
Mr. Jordan, where is the prejudice, the Strickland prejudice in this case? The outcome of the trial would have been different.
It would not have been.
You had my understanding is it was the same evidence. I read part of that record. The same evidence would have come in whether they're tried jointly or separately. It was the whole idea of consolidating the case at the beginning, wasn't it?
Yes, that is the whole
same evidence.
Same evidence in both cases. Here, the appellate, with it being a claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, the focus, of course, is would it have had a different outcome on appeal.
But certainly, you still got to show strict prejudice.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
But in this case, what Mr. Blackmon said, he told counsel, well,
had to show prejudice on appeal. He had to show a different outcome in the case.
Yes, he would, and he cannot do that. In this case... Well,
counsel, let me ask you this. On ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, I believe the law is that he doesn't have to show that if he got a reversal, let's say he shows a reasonable probability of a different result on appeal. He gets a reversal. He doesn't have to show he would have been acquitted or convicted of a lesser offense on retrial, does he?
No.
Okay. So then the question is, if he could have pointed to a Holloway violation on direct appeal in the record, that is, somebody objected or tantamount to objecting, and the district court did nothing, that would have gotten him a new trial, would it not have?
That would have gotten him a new trial.
Okay, so then doesn't this boil down to whether or not, at least as it the first of their second, the appellate counsel ineffectiveness claim boils down to whether or not there was in the record that the appellate counsel had a Holloway objection?
There was none.
I know. But isn't that the pivotal issue?
Exactly. All right.
So he says, but at the pretrial proceeding, one of the pretrial proceedings, one of the defendants did say something that is tantamount to an objection about the conflict of interest risk. Now, what's your response to that?
That record was not before the Florida First District Court of Appeal when it adjudicated this claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel on the merits.
You're talking about on collateral review when it adjudicated this. The pretrial record was not before the DCA?
No.
I thought state courts like us took judicial notice of anything and everything in the in any proceeding involving the case. Is that not correct?
That is not correct. In Florida, claims of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel are brought before the court, which heard the direct appeal. And it is an original proceeding in Florida, which means it is brought by a petition. And the record is the duty of the petitioner to bring forth the record on which
Mr. Jordan, the court has the case is still on appeal. The court has everything that came up on direct appeal before it.
It is not before them on this petition.
No. They had a whole record before it, before they ruled on direct appeal.
Yes.
Okay. Then there's a habeas petition filed on charging appellate counsel ineffectiveness. Then the court had the entire record before it. It's already seen the record. Is my understanding.
No, not in Florida. It is an original proceeding, meaning it is Mr. Blackman.
I understand that, but it already had the record of the entire case before it on direct appeal. The same judges, the same three judges that ruled on the habeas petition, that ruled on the appeal.
Not necessarily the same judges.
Well, they were different judges?
No, Your Honor. Just not necessarily the same three. But this,
what was it in this case?
I don't know that off the top of my head. But these are the procedures that Florida appellate courts follow in these cases of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. Mr. Blackmon attached an appendix to his record. If he wanted the entire record on direct appeal to be before the Florida First District Court of Appeal, he could have asked that court to take judicial notice of the direct appeal record. He did not.
Hypothetically, let's consider that they did have that record before them, imputed to them. Anything these defendants said pretrial they had before them. What's your response to opposing counsel's argument that they raised the conflict of interest in that pretrial proceeding?
Mr. Earl mentioned that himself.
I don't know who did. You're asking me questions.
It was not Mr. Blackman.
All right. Let's suppose, so your response to his argument that that was, if it was before the court, adequate to raise the Holloway issue is no, because he didn't do it, somebody else did it.
What he said was, well, made it. He made what was basically a statement of a potential conflict, not an actual conflict.
But it would be different, wouldn't it, if Mr. Blackman had made the statement that Mr. Earl made?
I think it would, yes.
So you would lose if Mr. Blackman had said what Mr. Earl said?
No, I don't think so.
So then it doesn't make a difference. You got to pick one or the other, counsel.
It doesn't make a difference because
all right. So if your client Blackman had said at that hearing exactly what Earl said, that wouldn't have mattered. Why?
Because there was no direct statement of what any conflict was. Again, that record was not before the First District Court of Appeal when it adjudicated this claim on the merits. This court in Pope said it is a clear, emphatic rule. Cullen v. Penholster. The First District Court of Appeal cannot be faulted for reaching the conclusion that it did based on Mr. Blackman's failure to produce a record. Based on the record before it, its adjudication of Mr. Blackman's claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel was not reasonable. And reasonableness under ADPA is what is required.
Were those remarks argued in the briefs before the DCA? Were those remarks of Earl at that pretrial proceeding argued or mentioned in the briefs that Blackman filed or that were filed on his behalf before the DCA?
I don't think they were. It was only Mr. Blackman's petition. Florida, based on the record before, apparently, first DCA did not deem it necessary to ask a response from the state.
Did Mr. Blackman cite any evidence from his trial before the appellate court on him?
I'm sorry, could you please repeat that, please?
Did Mr. Blackman cite any evidence from his trial when he was making his habeas claim to the appellate court?
No, the only thing he said was that after Chester testified that he saw him driving up and down the road, that was an actual conflict of interest because he told counsel in an off-the-record conversation that he wanted to testify. And counsel said, no, that'll hurt Earl. However, Strickland Supreme Court expressly states that the reasonableness of counsel's actions may be determined or influenced by the defendant's own statements or actions to counsel. However, in this case, Mr. Blackman never alleged to the post-conviction court or any other time that he told appellate counsel of any such off-the-record conversation. The appellate counsel cannot be faulted for failing to divine the scenario from Chester's testimony alone. In the first DCA could have reasonably arrived at the same conclusion. Based on the record before it, its adjudication of Mr. Blackman's claim is not unreasonable. For that reason, this court should affirm.
Thank you. Any other questions? No? All right, thank you. Mr. Suma, you've got 3 minutes left, or possibly four.
Three. Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to emphasize that the objection that is required under the Holloway case does not have to come from the lips of defense counsel. There are other means of getting that on the record. When the prosecutor asked to get a waiver of conflict of interest on the record, that constitutes an objection under Holloway. This court has a case on that point, and the case is called MERS, M-E-R-S. And by the way, when Mr. Earle uttered the magic words conflict of interest, Mr. Blackman's attorney at that point adopted Mr. Earle's statements.
Counsel lives in Holloway, a direct appeal.
I believe
Holloway is reviewing on direct appeal from the Supreme Court of Arkansas on direct appeal.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's an entirely different posture from a habeas corpus proceeding, which is collateral.
I understand, Your Honor. I understand.
Are you arguing? Well, let me ask you this. Are you arguing that this is a second, the habeas petition is in effect a second bite at the appeal, a direct appeal?
Well, it never
or, is. Or reviewing the direct appeal?
It never
is. No,
it never is, Your Honor. But
it can't
even
be.
But even under the conditions that we have here, prejudice can be found, is what I'm saying.
I've read the transcript the record that was supporting the habeas petition. I can't find any.
Okay, I thought that the transcript of the hearing pre-trial on the motion to consolidate was attached to that petition. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong.
I don't think it's there. And the habeas petition had more than this argument you're making now.
Yes, but
on the appellate counsel was ineffective on several grounds, including jury selection and one thing and another.
Right, but
which is why those parts of the record were made part of the record.
I understand, but a number of proceedings were attached to it, and I thought that was attached to it. And even if it's not attached to it, we expect the appellate court to review the records of the trial in cases like this. I'm out of time. On issue two, I'll rely on my briefs, but I would simply reiterate my point that the objections of conflict of interest are clear on the record that was available to the appellate court and the habeas petition. And I thank the court for its time today.
Thank you. We appreciate your argument and that of your opposing counsel. And this court will be in recess.